I just realized I left my Bible out there somewhere, and I might need that. Thank you, Judge. Okay. Yeah, might come in handy. Okay, well, we are returning today to our study through the book of Job. Took a 1 week break last week to talk about the deacons and elders. But today we will be continuing to look at Job's response to what one of his friends, Zophar, had said to him. We started looking at those verses a couple weeks ago, and we'll finish that particular speech of Job's up this morning. At this point, all three of Job's friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, have all spoken to Job. They all agree that the only explanation for Job to be suffering in the way that he is that he must have sinned in some way. Job continues to say that that is not the reason that he is suffering. He doesn't understand the reason for his suffering, but he feels certain that it's not because of some sin that he's committed. Job's response to Zophar's speech is found in Job 12, 13, and 14. We started looking at the first half of that a couple weeks ago. And so what we saw in that first part of his response is that Job sharply rebukes his friends. Their counsel was very conceited, arrogant. He disagrees with their claim that it's not possible for a righteous man to suffer. He says that's not true. Righteous men suffer. He said that nature itself really bears witness to the fact that the reality is that people do not always get the punishment or reward in this life that they really deserve. Job also called his friends worthless physicians. And when you think about what a worthless physician would be, I think one of the main characteristics would be they totally misdiagnose the problem. Then they would be worthless and also actually even dangerous, not just worthless. But they're worthless. They have completely misdiagnosed what Job's issues are. And actually he feels that they should be rebuked by God for what they have said. But we're going to pick up Job's response now in chapter 13, verse 13, and then we'll work our way through the end of chapter 14, just a paragraph at a time. So first off, Job 13, verses 13 through 19. Be silent before me so that I may speak. Then let come on me what may. Why should I take my flesh in my teeth and put my life in my hands? Though he slay me, I will hope in him. Nevertheless, I will argue my ways before him. This also will be my salvation, for a godless man may not come before his presence. Listen carefully to my speech, and let my declaration fill your ears. Behold, now I have prepared my case. I know that I will be vindicated. Who will contend with me? For then I would be silent and die. So in these verses, we see that Job repeats his desire to have his day in court with God. He recognizes that God may slay him, but he believes he will be vindicated. Back in chapter 9, in an earlier speech, Job had said he would like to present his case before God in a courtroom-type situation. Zophar responded later and said, Job, that's not going to work. You will definitely be found guilty, so you should not even be wanting that. Well, in spite of what Zophar said, Job repeats his desire to have his day in court with God. Verse 15 is a well-known verse. Though he slay me, I will hope in him. Nevertheless, I will argue my ways before him. Now, we're going to look at what Job has to say here in more detail a little later this morning. But for now, just notice that he says, even if God should slay him, he still wants to argue his case before the Lord. Once again, this is this courtroom-type setting. Arguing his case before the Lord. He says down in verse 18, I have prepared my case, and I know that I will be vindicated. So he is confident that he shares his case before the Lord, that he will be found not guilty. And it's interesting here because one of the main things that the friends are accusing him of, first off, like we said, is that he's committed some sin. He's done something. That's the explanation for all of this. And so they've even gone to the extent of calling him a hypocrite because he keeps saying, I've not sinned. And, you know, gave the impression all up to his life to this point of being a righteous man. So they said, you must not be righteous. You must be a hypocrite. Well, one thing that's important here, I think, to keep in mind, the very fact that Job says, I want to appear before God, I want to argue my case before him, that's not something a hypocrite would say. I mean, the last thing a hypocrite wants to do is stand before God, who knows everything, and give an account. So he really, in that sense, is actually arguing against what they have accused him of being a hypocrite. Hypocrites don't want to stand face to face with God. They know the reality. So, interesting that Job wants that. I think that speaks well of him in many ways. Okay, look now at the next paragraph, verse 20 to 28. It says, only two things do not do to me. Then I will not hide from your face. Remove your hand from me, and let not the dread of you terrify me. Then call, and I will answer. Or let me speak, then reply to me. How many are my iniquities and sins? Make known to me my rebellion and my sin. Why do you hide your face and consider me your enemy? Will you cause a driven leaf to tremble? Or will you pursue the dry chaff? For you write bitter things against me and make me to inherit the iniquities of my youth. You put my feet in the stocks and watch all my paths. You set a limit for the soles of my feet while I'm decaying like a rotten thing, like a garment that is moth-eaten. Here, Job now speaks directly to God and questions him about his iniquities, why God hides his face, and why he's treated like God's enemies. Up to this point, in this particular speech, Job really has been speaking to his friends primarily. Now he makes the turn, and now he's speaking directly to God, beginning in this particular paragraph. And at this point, he begins to kind of pepper God with questions. Well, three in particular, verses 23 to 25. How many are my iniquities and sins? Make known to me my rebellion and my sin. Why do you hide your face and consider me your enemy? Will you cause a driven leaf to tremble? Will you pursue the dry chaff? So he's questioning God. You know, these why questions. And he wants to know, why, God, are you acting so hostile toward me? Why? What is going on here? In verse 26, Job suggests that maybe God is punishing him for sins of his youth. But he's not sure, clearly, what's going on. That's why he's asking why. Verse 28, we get an insight here into what's happening to Job's body. I mean, physically speaking, the condition that he's dealing with. It says in verse 18, I'm decaying like a rotten thing, like a garment that's moth-eaten. So basically, he's saying, that's what's going on in my flesh. I'm wasting away. My flesh is actually decaying as if a moth was eating at a garment and destroying the garment. That's what's happening to my body. And he's really saying that, in a sense, he's wasting away under the heavy hand of God on him. Okay, chapter 14, verses 1 through 6. Man who is born of woman is short-lived and full of turmoil. Like a flower, he comes forth and withers. He also flees like a shadow and does not remain. You also open your eyes on him and bring him into judgment with yourself. Who can make the clean out of the unclean? No one. Since his days are determined, the number of his months is with you, and his limits you have set so that he cannot pass. Turn your gaze from him that he may rest until he fulfills his day like a hired man. In these verses, Job speaks of how man's life is short and full of turmoil. So comparatively speaking, man's life is a short-lived life. And he clearly acknowledges God's sovereignty over life. Verse 5 is another fairly well-known verse in Job. He says, since his days, talking about man in general, his days are determined. The number of his months is with you, and his limits you have set so that he cannot pass. God has determined the number of months, more specifically, the number of days that each person will live. God has ordained that. And he's also ordained that no one will go past the limit that he has set for each individual person. Now, in light of that, Job is basically saying that really life is too short. Life is too short to be hounded by God during your life. And as he's done before, what he's asking God here is basically, turn your gaze away from me so I can just rest, so I can just get some relief, you know, in whatever days I have left. Now, the next section, Job goes from speaking about man's life to speaking about his death. So verses 7 to 17, we'll read here. For there is hope for a tree when it's cut down, that it will sprout again, and its shoots will not fail. Though its roots grow old in the ground, and its stump dies in the dry soil, at the scent of water it will flourish and put forth sprigs like a plant. But man dies and lies prostrate. Man expires, and where is he? As water evaporates from the sea, and a river becomes parched and dried up, so man lies down and does not rise until the heavens are no longer. He will not awake, nor be aroused out of his sleep. Oh, that you would hide me in Sheol, that you would conceal me until your wrath returns to you, that you would set a limit for me and remember me. If a man dies, will he live again? All the days of my struggle I will wait until my change comes. You will call and I will answer you. You will long for the work of your hands. For now you number my steps. You do not observe my sin. My transgression is sealed up in a bag, and you wrap up my iniquity. So Job now speaks of the finality of man's death and begins to express some hope in a resurrection. As you notice, he compares the death of a man to a tree that's been cut down. The tree's cut down, but the roots that remain in the ground, they can be there for a while, but he says, you know, they have potential to sprout up again, the roots that are there. But then in comparison to that, man, he doesn't give that same, in his understanding at this point, that's not the same as man. He says in verse 10, when man dies, he lies prostrate. Man expires, and where is he? Verse 12, so man lies down and does not rise. Until the heavens are no longer, he will not awake nor be aroused out of his sleep. So basically he's saying when man dies, it's over. Then, Job begins to, he's continuing to think. He's continuing to wrestle with these things and begins to think of it being otherwise. He then begins to consider that maybe there could be more than just you're dead and you're gone. More than what he's understood to this point. And I think it's important to look at what he says again in verse 13 to 15. Because a significant revelation is beginning to dawn on him. He says, oh, that you would hide me in Sheol. Now, Sheol, sometimes we equate that with hell. That's not hell. Sheol is just what they call the place of the dead. So he just says, you know, hide me in the place of the dead. That you would conceal me until your wrath returns to you. That you would set a limit for me and remember me. If a man dies, will he live again? All the days of my struggle, I will wait until my change comes. You will call and I will answer you. You will long for the work of your hands. What he's considering here is resurrection from the grave. He's considering resurrection. Now, we have to understand, at this time in history and the progression of revelation that God gave, their understanding of what happened after death was very cloudy, very murky. They did not have real clarity on what happened after you died. They knew Sheol, the place of the dead. But beyond that, there was not a lot of clarity. And so Job has actually begun to consider something that is beyond what most men of this day really understood. And one of the things that's one of the things that we see happening in the book of Job, really in several areas, is that as Job wrestles with his suffering, as he wrestles with his friends' counsel and what they're saying to him, and then he wrestles with God, like we see here. I mean, he comes to understand some truths with more clarity. And I think that's probably one of the purposes of Job's sufferings, is there are a number of things, a number of different truths that come more clear, that people are going to read and that Job comes to see that would not have been discovered apart from all the suffering that he endured and even the way he had to endure it, including his friends' really just mean counsel in many ways, as well as being misdiagnosed. But one of the things that becomes more clear to him, little by little, is what happens beyond the grave and having more clarity with that. There's a quote here by William Henry Green describing this particular section. He says, Job is trembling here on the verge of a hope full of immortality, which is soon to assume its proper form before his mind and to swell to its just dimensions. But it is as yet only inadequately conceived by him. He's beginning to get it. He's beginning to see something more clear than he's seen it before. But as we look at the final verses of this speech in chapter 14, he's not able to hold on to that glimpse of hope. He kind of falls back into lamenting. So look at verses 18 to 22. But the crumbling mountain crumbles, the falling mountain crumbles away, and the rock moves from its place. Water wears away stones. Its torrents wash away the dust of the earth. So you destroy man's hope. You forever overpower him and he departs. You change his appearance and send him away. His sons achieve honor, but he does not know it, or they become insignificant, but he does not perceive it. But his body pains him, and he mourns only for himself. So in these final verses of this speech, we see that Job's hope fades away as he considers the reality of a constant affliction resulting in death. He's pained at thinking that man will not know what becomes of his family after he dies. So he begins to think of falling mountains and the mountains just crumbling away. He speaks of water wearing down stones, you know, just over time, and talks about the water washing away the dust of the earth. And he compares that to life. So what he's basically saying here is life is hard and then you die. So he's back to that. He had a brief hope there of resurrection, but now he comes back and he just sees death as being an ending point, mostly. He then considers the fact that once again, you can just see this is a lament. He's lamenting here again. He considers the fact that for a man who dies, who has sons, he says if his sons achieve honor after he dies or they become just completely insignificant, he won't know. He's not going to know what happened to his sons because he's dead and gone. So as usual, Job's discourse has highs and lows. He goes up and down. And as usual, we find that there are lots of significant truths in the things that Job says and the things he's considered. Now, as I mentioned as we were going through this, one of the better known quotes of Job is found in chapter 13, verse 15. Though he slay me, I will hope in him, or I will trust in him. And I think it's worth our time to spend the rest of our time this morning just on that one statement. So that's what we're going to do. So in our second point, Job's remarkable confession of hope and trust in the Lord. So let's consider first some implications of the first part of the statement where he says, though he slay me. Now, Job clearly understands that it is God who is responsible for the time of his death. We already mentioned that back in chapter 14, verse 4. He says it's God who numbers our days and he sets a limit and no man can go past the number of days that God has ordained for him. So he understands that. But Job is not only speaking of the time that God allows him to die. The way he says this, he says, though he slay me, he's speaking of God taking an active part in his death. He understands there's an active role there. It's not just God just watches or just kind of allows it to happen. So let's note, first of all, a couple things that we can, I think, pull from this. First, this tells us we need to submit to God's absolute sovereignty in your life. Submit to it. God is sovereign over your life, and you are not. He's determined, first off, that you would exist. God determined that, not you and not your parents. He determined at what time in history you would be born. He determined who your parents would be. He determined who your family would be, whether by birth or adoption. He determined that. He has determined where you would be born. He is sovereign over the details of your life. He's sovereign over the details of your death. And like Job, our responsibility to that is to submit. I mean, our life, every heartbeat, every breath is fully dependent on the Lord. The details of our death are also in His hand. We don't know what those details are, so it's really useless to worry about them. We have a tendency to worry about those kind of things, but it doesn't help to worry about those kind of things. They're really not in your hand. Now, an understanding of this truth can really give you a lot of courage to know that your death is not in your hand. It's in His hand. I'm going to give you a couple examples of that. Most of you know the story of Esther in the Old Testament. In God's providence, Esther was chosen to be the queen of Persia, even though she was Jewish. The king had agreed to a decree that would have resulted in the annihilation of the Jewish people. And the only hope, what they understand to be their best hope, maybe I should say, was for Esther to approach the king about this ruling, about this decree that would result in the annihilation of the Jews. She balked at that because she knew very well that to come into the presence of the king, even though she was the queen, for anyone to come into the presence of the king without being summoned was a death sentence. It meant death. You had to be summoned before you could come into the presence of the king. Now, here's how her cousin Mordecai spoke to her about this decision. This is in Esther chapter 4, verses 13 to 16. Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?" Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, and I and my maidens will fast in the same way. And thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish." In other words, though he slay me, I will trust in him. If I perish, I perish. My death is not in my hands. That can give you courage. I'll give you another example of that. During the war between the states, one of my favorite characters is Stonewall Jackson, Southern general. And he was known for his godliness. He was also known for his courage. And there was a captain who came up, and his courage was noticeable. And there was a captain who came up after and talked to him about this. And here's how he responded to him. He says, "Captain, my religious belief teaches me to feel as safe in battle as in bed. God has fixed the time for my death. I do not concern myself about that, but to be always ready, no matter when it may overtake me. Captain, that is the way all men should live, and then all would be equally brave." It can make a difference. It can make a difference. We are called to submit to God's absolute sovereignty in our life and in our death. A second implication from this phrase, "though he slay me," I think, is this. A quote from Matthew Henry. "We must be well pleased with God as a friend, even when he seems to come forth as an enemy." Be well pleased with God as a friend, even when he seems to come forth as an enemy. Though he slay me. It's one thing to trust the Lord when we're healthy, good income, nice place to live, good friends, family. We can genuinely say God is good and we love him. But what about when things seem to be falling apart around you? Your job is a pain, or maybe non-existent. Your health is a constant issue. People you love are suffering or may even be the victim of a horrible crime. Is God still good? Do we still love him? When Jesus got word that his friend Lazarus was near death, he didn't go right away. He chose not to go immediately, and by the time he got there, Lazarus had been dead for 4 days. Now, obviously, Jesus was one that everybody knew he could have done something about that. And so that's why they called for him. They knew, I mean, he often healed people. And so Lazarus' sisters, Mary and Martha, really just could not understand why Jesus did not come sooner. If he'd come sooner, Lazarus wouldn't have died. So they couldn't understand why Jesus was acting in that way toward them. Of course, what they didn't realize is that Jesus intended to raise Lazarus from the dead. And of course, he did. But just because the Lord doesn't act in the way that we expect him to act, doesn't mean he's forsaken us. We still are supposed to be pleased with him as a friend. I want to read some verses for you from Romans chapter 8, 35 to 39, that I think illustrates this very well. Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Well, tribulation. This is a pretty bad thing he's mentioning here, by the way. Tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, or sword. Just as it is written, for your sake we are being put to death all day long. By the way, that phrase there, we're being put to death all day long, sounds like torture. In other words, it's a slow death. For your sake, we're being put to death all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. But in all these things, we overwhelmingly conquer through him who loved us. For I'm convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing will be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Another way to say that would be, though he slay me, I will trust him. What is it about God that tells us or that can convince us that he does love us, even when he seems to be acting toward us as an enemy? Well, first off, two answers to that I would give. One is that if you think about his character, we have to remember who our God is. And the catechism question that I think sums this up really as well as any single sentence that I've ever seen, trying to sum up who God is. God is a spirit, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. It would take volumes of books to unpack that simple sentence. But when you just think about a few of those things, he's unchangeable, he's infinite, he's eternal, for example, in his wisdom. That includes everything that takes place in yours and my life. He's infinite, he's eternal, he's unchangeable in his goodness. In his goodness. Things don't always feel good in our situation. But if we can continue to remind ourselves and remember who he is, and who he is not determined by our perception of circumstances. It's determined by what the Scripture says and reveals to us about who he is. And that's what we hold to. But another aspect of that is not just his character in general, but as Christians, more specifically, we need to call to mind that we are actually in covenant with God through Jesus Christ. Earlier in that same Romans 8 passage that I read a few minutes ago, Paul says, if God is for us, who is against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how will he not also with him freely give us all things? So basically what he's saying there, if God gave his son for sinful and ungodly people like us, and now that he has brought us into his family, and now that he has forgiven us, and now that he has made us righteous, made us his children, he cannot fail to give you everything you need for your salvation to continue and prosper like it should. If he didn't fail you when you were sinful and ungodly, he's certainly not going to fail you now that you're forgiven and righteous and his own child. He won't leave us. He won't forsake us. And we need to be well pleased with God as a friend, even when he seems to come forth as an enemy. Though he slay me. Okay, let's look a little more closely at the second part of Job's statement. I will hope, or it could also be trust in him. So though he slay me, I will trust in him. We started by saying that this statement was a reference to God's absolute sovereignty in our lives, over our life, over our death, and that our response to that needs to be to submit to His sovereignty in our lives. But we need to add to that. Does that mean you just sit back and do nothing? Well, God's in charge no matter what I do. My days are all determined. It's up to Him. Just wait and see what happens. That's not what it means. That's not how we respond. That's not what the submission is talking about. Because Job says there's something you need to do. What is that?